London is the place for me. London, this lovely city. You can go to France or America.
London is the place for me is what Lord Kitchener sang as he stepped off HMT Empire Windrush at Tilbury Docks in 1948. And that is where our story begins today. Ironically, the song lyrics exclaim that the English people will make you feel like a millionaire, when in fact the story we're looking at today suggests the complete opposite. We are reading the Mistress of Suspense, Louise Hare's book, This Lovely City, an atmospheric and utterly compelling debut novel about a Jamaican immigrant living in post-war London. This Lovely City shows that new arrivals have always been the prime suspects, but that even in the face of anger and fear, there is always hope. I'm so excited to be joined today by some of the members of the BAME network who are taking over today's podcast. Would you guys be able to introduce yourself and let me know in one word, how did This Lovely City make you feel?
Hello, my name is Michael, and disappointed, but not with the book.
Hi, I'm Zenith. I would say proud, being a British-born Jamaican. The book definitely made me feel proud.
Hi, I'm Neera, and I would say that the book made me feel moved.
I like that. And obviously, you know, I'm Freya, and I would say the book left me feeling... I was left wanting by the book. I felt like I needed to know that everything was going to be okay. And it left it on a bit of a cliff edge where I was like, are they going to be okay? They've been through so much. So just elaborate on that a little bit more. Why?
So I wasn't disappointed with the book. I thought it was a fantastic read, probably one of the best books I've read in a while. But some of the themes and things they were talking about, especially around how people of colour were treated, I feel nowadays it's a lot softer, but a lot of the same methods of treatment and feelings are there, just kind of more well hidden because it's not societally accepted, if that makes sense.
Yeah, complete sense.
But the book itself, yeah, fantastic. And yeah, I agree with Zenith. Proud is also something it did make me feel.
I accept everything you said and I agree with it totally. I think it almost felt like it wasn't 1948.
Yeah.
It could have been, you know, 2021.
Lockdown days.
It felt very current, which I can understand why you chose the word disappointed, because it feels like not much has changed.
So moved, because that was the only word that I could think of that summed up everything that Michael and Zenith and Freya have also said about it, because it just covered so much. And Michael, I completely agree with what you said, that it's really sad and disappointing that these things are still happening. I remember I was reading as an ebook, and as I was going through, I was like highlighting different passages, and I had like a whole colour highlight for like subtle racism and microaggressions and things that I noticed in the book that Louise has brought up really well.
Amazing. So speaking of, so you read on the ebook, so you guys read the paper versions?
Yep.
Yeah, so did we all see the cover?
Yes.
So your kind of first impression of the cover, obviously it's really bright for anybody who hasn't seen it, super bright, you've got people dancing on the front, there's stars. Is the impression that you got from the cover the same impression that you got having finished the book?
I would say no.
Mm.
So I know music was a big theme of the book, but I think the main aspects of the book were not reflected on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost like a distraction, like we're going to focus on jazz and music while there's a much bigger issue taking place.
I think it reflected maybe the first 3 or 4 chapters,
and then
it was just a bit like, whoa, okay. Because at the beginning, obviously, music is, you see it as their passion and something they love, and it's obviously quite positive. With the scene kind of in the club, them playing, enjoying themselves, and then music then carries on as a theme throughout the rest, but next to music there's always a negative connotation then, so even kind of what they loved was tainted by the views. Yeah, it definitely threw you off, much past like chapter 5 or 6.
It was like strap in.
Yeah.
I thought for a ride.
I thought it would be a really positive book, and I was like, yeah,
yeah,
spoiler alert.
Yeah, the colours and everything, and the imagery was so upbeat and positive. I think we all go before we went into it would have just from looking at the cover expected something different. I think that the cover's chosen deliberately to highlight the positive portrayal and impact of immigrant communities, rightly so, like the Windrush generation, as well as just in general. But also to underline the irony in the title, This Lovely City, that these are all your expectations of coming here, and that's what you think it's going to be, and it's all community and music, and that is a big part of it. But
like the Dick Whittington, I know he mentioned, she wrote that in the book, and he mentioned that kind of, you know, I felt like maybe I should have been a bit more like Dick Whittington.
Exactly.
The reality was not that at all.
Yeah, you think the streets will be paved with gold, everyone will be welcoming, you know. There was a quote in there about how the newspapers had said that we were made to feel welcome, and this was our home, and it wasn't.
Yeah. Did you like that? Did you like the use of the kind of phone newspaper cuttings?
Yeah, I think it worked really well to illustrate the story from a non-kind of storytelling perspective. It was, oh, they were seeing this, and because they reference newspapers so much, it's really interesting to see kind of the language used in the newspapers and how they were talking about the suspects and the people, and the black people. I really did enjoy it, and it just added like quite a different spin on what it's just text.
Yeah, because you're not just following what the people are living, you're also aware now of what society's thinking and all of the tensions that were building up until the wedding that they played. Yeah. But that was kind of the...
it burst in through.
So what character could you relate to the most and why?
Well, I mentioned being British, born Jamaican, so Laurie was definitely the character that I identified with the most. And there was lots of elements of his journey and his story that I've heard in, you know, family's recollection of the past. So that all felt very familiar. That felt like that could have been my grandfather. But otherwise, I think...
the girl's name?
I forgot her name. Evie. She was obviously a very likeable character, wasn't she? But yeah, I think Laurie was the one that really captured my heart.
I think I kind of had two. So I'm British born and biracial, and so is Evie. I didn't grow up around my black family, so I had to teach myself a lot about that. And I think her coming from that perspective where society sees you as a black person, doesn't even take into consideration anything else, is something I identified with a lot growing up. But also then when she sees all of the black people come into London, that feeling of kind of, oh, people who look like me. When I went to secondary school, I kind of had that because it was much more diverse and I had more people I could identify with on that level. And then also Laurie, because the way he was kind of treating his run-ins with the police, I've never been in trouble with police, but growing up in London when I was a teenager, I used to get stopped and searched at least 2-3 times a week. And it was always a kind of, you're guilty until we've proved you're not, type of thing. And that's why I was disappointed at the beginning, because that's still very prevalent now. Like I'd be out with some of my friends who are white, we get stopped by 3 police officers and one would search the 2 of them and I'd have 2 standing by me. And it's like, is that fair when we're in a 3, you're in a 3, take one each. Like it's, I do think there's something that's still kind of around today. And I think it does come down to kind of the way society still, I think as a whole, paints a picture of migrants and people of colour. It's not fair. It kind of is still painted in such a way, maybe not as aggressively as those extracts you see in the book, but it's still quite negative. So
that's it.
And I feel even subconsciously people don't realise it, but they carry these preconceptions. So that's why, I think him as well.
So I'd also agree with Laurie as well. So Michael, what you were saying about Evie, I kind of understand her position because I was born in Africa, but I came here when I was very young, so I feel much more British. But I would say Laurie, because he is in a way quite naive and he's really optimistic. And he has this whole idea, as we said, about Dick Whittington and, you know, what it's going to be like. He has this whole idea of what society should be like. And then that naivety kind of that it shows that he's a bit fallible and people will use him in certain ways. but he stays hopeful and lets all of the experiences make him better and not bitter.
Yeah. Which is, I think, really nice. I think that goes back to that kind of hope aspect of, like, I'd say Laurie is the main bringer of hope throughout the book, that he always tries to look on the bright side, which I thought was just really added a really lovely, heartwarming element to some aspects that didn't make you feel very nice reading.
No.
I really agree.
Yeah.
And Michael, what you were saying about, like, the police, and kind of we see it from Laurie's point of view, then we see it from the newspaper's point of view, and the comments from some of the rest of society, and how people just feel acceptable to say certain things. It goes back to the word that you chose, disappointing, that people still, some people still think in those ways.
It's people being sold a narrative and buying into it without thinking broader. I think that's what's disappointing about it, is on a whole society is a lot better, but there is still enough individuals that it's obvious that people still do buy into these narratives and still believe these things because it's what mainstream media paints a picture of, if you get what I mean. And yes, a lot better than back then, but it's not, well, less aggressive than back then. But it's definitely still not solved, it's not gone.
Yeah.
People are still extremely ignorant and use that ignorance, I'm using air quotes for people listening, to back up really horrible and stupid points of view that, like, don't really have any place being anywhere. And I think you are right, the media really, like, feeds that fire off to its own end. And it was actually really interesting. Obviously, I'm not coming from the same point of view that you guys are, but reading the newspaper articles and seeing that and being like, this is so stupid, how could anybody read that and, like, agree with it? And then you see, like, the women on the bus, you know, being like, oh, of course this was going to happen. And you're just like, you're so stupid.
Yeah.
You're so stupid.
And it's like, if they thought about it logically, what do they think is going to happen with their baby just seeing a friendly lady? But that's not how they look at it.
No.
I think it's people use the media as a justification of their ignorance. Mm-hmm. And they don't even look to question it because it supports a point of view they either want to have, or what point of view they've kind of inherited from the people around them that they haven't been given a real opportunity to challenge yet, or directly being challenged about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I would have challenged you on the bit where you said it's almost less aggressive now.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it is. I guess obviously we didn't live in that time, so we don't know. But I guess it feels like it's so complex now. It's not just newspapers. It's like television. It's social media. It's almost everywhere that it almost feels more aggressive. Mm-hmm. And it's not just one voice. It's like multiple voices. I would just challenge that. I feel like if you're living through that experience now, it probably feels just as aggressive, if not more, now.
Yeah, no, I think I agree with that. I think it's in many more places now, so you can't escape it. It's kind of everywhere you look, there is a picture being portrayed of somebody unfairly negatively, just to support a narrative that the others are the ones that are causing problems, like you said earlier. But I think what they've got good at now is using language that a lot of people don't initially see as aggressive, so therefore it goes under the radar and people are like, oh, but they haven't said anything bad, they're just saying, like, but I think, or they haven't portrayed it as a negative. So in movies, a black character is often the criminal or portrayed as a gangster, and it's like, well, that's just a minority of the black people in Britain, but that's, especially in London, that's how it's viewed by many. And you see it in the movie, they say, oh, that's not negative, they're just playing a character in the show. So it's less aggressive in that aspect.
Yeah.
But then when it's happening on 100 movies and series and books and the newspaper, that's where, to be fair, I do agree with you.
Yeah, and I think you're right. It's more about that kind of dog whistling, about making it sound almost acceptable. So having just enough politeness, or the way it's said, with just that insinuation rather than outright slurs and stereotyping and things, so that they can say, well, that's not what I meant, and you're misinterpreting it.
That's it. I think it's insinuation, not accusation, which is the difference from the articles you see in the book. They're outright telling you that's what it is, whereas now they won't necessarily say it's everyone, but they write an article that, if that's what you want to believe, that's exactly how you read it.
Mm-hmm.
or that's how the movies are portrayed and things like that.
Just to mention as well, I think it affects all of us. So even if it's not something that you believe, we're as humans very lazy. And if we just hear a message again and again and again, and it's repeated, your brain starts taking it in whether it's true or not.
Yeah, I think many of the views are subconsciously held by everyone. Even people who actively try to not hold them, you can't fully break those thoughts away from your, like, the way you perceive things around you, which is really sad. Even sometimes if you fall within the demographic that's being spoken about, you do have, not that you agree, but it will still be one of the first things that comes to your mind when something related to that comes up, which, it's really upsetting, actually, how powerful the media is in that respect.
Yeah, I guess that's why, you know, there was a time where there was a big emphasis on unconscious bias training, and I guess it was about bringing those kinds of thinking to your awareness, so you're now aware of it. Doesn't stop you from having, you know, those thoughts or thinking that way, but it means you're aware of it, so you catch yourself and maybe, you know, push it aside. And I think actually, as you've all said, I guess the difference is people's understanding and awareness of all these things. Because back then, I guess the black population were relatively new, so there wasn't a standard set, you know, decades of seeing that experience.
I'll challenge that. You say that, and I do agree with you, but also there's that whole kind of changing the narrative of people thinking that, oh, black people didn't exist in Britain until this time, and, you know, forgetting that they were around at the Roman Empire. They were. There's always been migrants and people of colour in Britain and everywhere, and it's like the whole Thanksgiving recently, you know, Columbus Day, he discovered America. Did he? they were there. We don't say people discovered the moon. Sorry, that was kind of off topic.
No. It's, you know, you're completely right. You know, we had a talk last year where I can't even remember what the examples were, but, you know, in part of the royal family's...
Who knows the words of these things?
In their lineage.
In the royal household, there was evidence of black people, you know, so, and, you know, there's been films made, you know, Dido and other people.
And the talk we had with David Olusoga for Black History Month as well.
Yeah, so there's many examples. I guess at that point in time, in the 1940s, it felt like a significant amount of black people, enough for it to disturb our local population.
Yeah.
I think even the book kind of references that when he talks about Evie's dad studying and being kind of an academic student in London. And obviously, there are still people then, like only, 15 years, 16 years before we had the same issues. But as you said, with the larger influx of black people coming, who were coming obviously very positively because they'd been invited, but then weren't received in the way they expected. But then it was still being reported on as if it was really positive. It's kind of, I think it's that culture shock where people are like, oh, this is my space.
Yeah.
This is mine. So like, what are these others, as you said earlier, like, why are these others coming into my space? Which I think it's because it was a larger group. It's why I think it's where everyone refers to is kind of the start, not that it was the start, but the big point, the breaking point in terms of that's when everything kind of went downhill, or when it all started on kind of a large scale.
And just on that point that you've spoken about people being invited, that feels like something that happened yesterday. I mean, there was was it just this week there's been conversations about temporary visas for Eastern Europeans to, you know,
truck drivers
or become butchers or pick fruit or whatever it is. I mean, there's always been a reason to invite immigrants to the UK. You know, at that point in time, it was, you know, to help repair, rebuild the country. Now it's because we need food and other things. But I think, obviously then, the newspapers was probably reporting it as a positive event because that was the political agenda at that point in time. That was the government's message. Whereas now, I mean, there's disparities between what the government is saying and doing and what the media is saying. You know, the government is saying informally that we need you. But we're not saying it in the same way, like, we need you. But we clearly do. But I don't know why we can't be more honest about that. As a country, we need immigrants.
I think Britain's built on immigrants, but it tries to hold face that it doesn't need it all. It is kind of self-made. When in actual fact, it's like, I'd say most major things that Britain's done has kind of involved, to some degree, immigrants from somewhere else. Like, it has.
Yeah, all resources. To this day.
All resources, yeah, exactly. Like, very proud of the fact we're able to invite these people over because they're from the Commonwealth and blah, 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 but never talk about the fact the only reason they're part of the Commonwealth is because we colonised them.
Yeah.
Which is, like, the interesting argument. It's, oh, we'll love to accept you when it's helping us, or love to say, oh, yeah, you're, like, you're welcome, but when it makes us look weak or bad, or it's like we never paint that narrative.
And that's the thing, history isn't about, you know, blaming, and it's not also about just always feeling happy and putting like rose-tinted glasses over everything, but it's like we can acknowledge the bad stuff. We're not saying that you as an individual did something wrong and you're not responsible for all of this, but equally, until we acknowledge things, we can't get past them.
I think the British education system is very good at acknowledging other countries' negatives, never our own. Like,
which is insane.
It's crazy. It's crazy. Like, you'll hear about the rest of Europe colonising every other country in the world, but never the ones England have colonised.
Or slavery.
Exactly.
American
slavery.
Really
bad. Yeah, like, well, we can go into depth on that, but not on England's part in the
Even if you look into it, because obviously we're near Harwich, which was one of the big ports, or is a port. So there would have been a huge amount of slaves coming in. And you look up on history, as I did... like, I think last year when I was interested, I was looking into it because I was like, it is weird that this isn't out in the popular, like, zones. Nothing. I went on the Essex record office, couldn't find anything. I went to Essex Uni and, like, couldn't find anything on their websites. The only thing I found was an article, and that is nowhere near acknowledging the part that we play.
Liverpool has a whole museum of slavery.
It's a good museum.
It's a fantastic museum. Circling back to another point about how that was when kind of black people and migrants became possibly more visible, is that there are still parts of the country now where people will have, say, one black child in a school, or they won't know people of other colours or different races. And I think we forget that because a lot of cities and certain counties are so multicultural.
I think growing up in or close to London, you're very fortunate that even if where you directly live isn't very diverse, you'll come across people from different cultures, backgrounds, races. One of my closest friends from uni is from the Valleys in Wales, and until she came to uni, had never met a black person.
Yeah.
Which to me was outstanding. I was like, wow, like, that's crazy. But also, like, didn't feel brave enough to tell me until we've been friends for like 3.5-4 years, which is also another like quite mad thing. It's like it's something she was embarrassed about. But it just goes to show, like, I think people look at England as being, or Britain as a whole, as being this crazy diverse place, but there are like bubbles of diversity, but there are still so many places which haven't really been touched by it.
But saying that, without the diversity necessarily in the population, they still evidence of diversity. So, for example, almost every place will have like a Chinese restaurant or an Indian takeaway. They all have those things without necessarily having a significant population to represent those communities.
Cherry picking the parts.
Which is kind of what the book like lays out, is that you can come over and we'd like you to labour for us, but we don't want to see you. We'd like you to go in the underground until you can find somewhere to hide away where someone will take you on. And I think that's like a very frustrating point of like the culture then, but also the culture now, of we'll welcome all the lovely bits, but the bits that maybe don't convenience us in the same way, you're going to have a hard time.
Or as soon as something goes wrong, you're representative of an entire race or an entire people's, but if something goes right, where you're doing something well, it's just, oh, you as an individual, you're one of the good ones, you're doing really well.
I think one thing that shocked me quite recently, I saw that Wales, the first country in the UK to be implementing Black History into their curriculum. And at first, I, like many people, said, oh, that's fantastic, like, so, like, making steps, fantastic. And then I was reading people's comments, and I was like, oh, actually, it's so true, that they were like, it sounds brilliant on paper, but until you actually see what the curriculum is, can you praise the success that it is? Because again, you don't know what what truths they're choosing to tell, what stories they're choosing to kind of to teach.
Yeah.
I guess that's another thing. The good thing about that is it's quite bold for any country to say in today's context to say that's what they're doing. And actually I almost feel like it came from nowhere. Mm-hmm. Like, there wasn't even like a build up to it. Yeah. But I guess in Wells' case, there's like lots of case studies. Like there's, you know, organizations that have already written curriculums. Mm-hmm. So actually they don't even have to do any work. Yeah, they could just take somebody else's work. So I guess for them, hopefully they will follow the example of those that have already done the legwork.
Yeah.
Let's, like you said, let's not rewrite the history. Just tell it the way how it exists.
Yeah. I do. It's a definitely a big step, and it is brave, I think, because there are lots of people who look at that and be like, "Oh, but why does that need to be included?" Or there are people who would be looking
because
at
it's not.
That's it. No, that's exactly the point. That it's not, and it makes no sense as to why it's not. But then it's crazy that some people look at it like, "Why should it be?"
It's like Black History Month. Some people will say, why do we need Black History Month? Why do we need International Women's Day? Because these things should be part of the whole story, but they're not.
We've had comments on social media that have been like, well, when's Black History Month? And it's like, every day of the year. Every day of the
and
year.
And then you go, when's International Men's Day? And you're like, actually, there is a day. This is the date. Are you going to do it?
Yeah.
Right? No, I didn't think so.
I guess that in itself, I mean, it's obviously part of the challenge, but it's just the fact that we obviously have described this part of history to be Black history, which is separate from British history.
Yeah.
And we're obviously not at that point yet, but that's hopefully where we will get to.
It's all one and the same. Again, it's cherry picking. It's picking the parts of history you want to say and not showing the links and how intertwined it all is. And by doing that, it means things like Black History Month focus on one aspect of history, and rightly so. But to some degree, I think for some people, it just supports their statement that it's separate because it's told as separate. You've got months to do yours.
Yeah. It's not just things like this. It's even things like Andy Murray. It's like, oh, when he was doing really well, yeah, he's a great British player. Yeah. And then if he wasn't doing well, it's like, oh, yeah, he's British.
So my final question is, what section of the book stuck with you most and why?
I think for me, it's the initial kind of arrests and that section when things just started to go bad and already things were terrible for the individuals. So Laurie and Evie, especially when they first got arrested, but also the similarities and differences there. So they both got arrested and were questioned, and every time they had an encounter with police, it was super aggressive. The woman who found the baby first was kind of let go, had a statement, went home. Laurie got pulled in thinking for a statement, was left in the room for hours in the dark with no clock, was kind of had his tires slashed. Kind of seeing that was just like, wow, when in actual fact he was an innocent bystander. Unfortunately, then, you know, was kind of wrapped up in it. He was close to it, but very unknowingly. And then you had the contrast, but also similarities of Evie being arrested, where I think it was no less aggressive, just a lot more verbal and emotional rather than physical. But then even little things, like initially, it was like, oh, she went in there, she had a cup of tea. But then the second time when they thought she was definitely a suspect, kind of certain, she was dragged out of her house by two police officers. So kind of those aspects of the police treatment, I think, will really stick with me. And again, like I said at the beginning, because I think although in terms of the physical aggression, maybe not as widely there. I think the prejudice and the view and the kind of guilty until proven innocent that sometimes that's seen in the book is still sometimes seen nowadays.
It seemed like with Evie as well, at first there was a bit of infantilization. They were kind of treating her like she didn't really know what was going on, and bless her, she was just this poor little girl and she couldn't possibly make her own mind up about anything.
I'm kind of stuck. I think I was most moved by the scenes between Evie and her mum when we realised that Evie had a baby. Something happened to the baby, we don't know. I felt that that to me was quite emotional. I guess it's very telling of those times that, you know, the shame that you would have brought being pregnant at that age. Not only being pregnant, but being pregnant by a Black man. And circumstances as to how you got pregnant. I guess it's a sign of the time then, but I think the same kind of shame would have existed now. You know, we hear often about low conviction rates associated with rape or domestic violence. So there's still elements of those things that exist now. I think I was just struck by the mum's mannerisms. There was just so many things about that woman that was so infuriating.
She was so, like, callous. Like, when Evie had asked her, she was like, oh, so you regret having me? And the mum was basically like, yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
there's a way to say, yeah. You know, I did go through some hardship, but it's not your fault, and
yeah.
Yeah, I think going back to what you said, Zane, but I think it's scary how that's not just a thing from then. Mm-hmm. I think there's still a lot of shame and a lot of negativity towards single mothers,
towards young mothers,
mm-hmm. towards rape victims who should never hold the shame in those situations. And yeah, I just think that's, yeah, it's crazy. That, I think that, again, disappointment, because these things just haven't changed in 60 years. Yes, I think as a whole, society is slowly getting there in terms of acceptance and the views people should have, but there's still such a proportion of society who don't hold them views or who will verbally advocate for the right message, but then when they're faced with the real issue, it's not actually how they act or how they feel.
I think that's the annoying part, is like acceptance. Mm-hmm. It's not like, I don't care. You, as long as you're not hurting anybody, do whatever you want with your life. It really isn't affecting me. It's like, oh, I'll accept that's happening. I guess I'll just have to accept that. I think that's the frustrating thing that I see a lot, is it's not, I have realised that I've been prejudiced about this, I'm now going to move on from that fact and just let those people live their life. It's, oh, I guess you're right. I guess I'll just let that happen now.
It's like you always get those people with phrases like, what's next? They'll be marrying cats and dogs, or like these slippery slope things where it's just going into the absurd, as you said. If people are happy and they're not hurting anyone,
why should you care?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think lots of people who fall into kind of those groups where they're in a minority group or they're seen as the others have that thing where people are, oh, well, they're different, so if they get it, oh, it's not fair. Or if it's something I can't identify with, it's like, oh, but then why should they have the same as me? But like, oh, it's the same with kind of women and women's votes. Like back then, oh, no, why should women get that? That's a men's thing. It got to a point where eventually it was like, okay, like that's why now let's move on to the next thing. Gay marriage, right? What, gays can't get married because this says so. But it's like, well, what does that have to do with your personal life?
Equal like, rights are not pie. It's not if somebody else gets rights, then it takes away a share of yours.
Yes.
And I think it comes down to that ignorance we were talking about earlier. It's people want exclusive rights to things they deem as being positive, and even though it doesn't take away from them for other groups to have it, it's then no longer their thing.
There's a quote that I love that says, to those accustomed to privilege, equality feels like oppression.
Mm-hmm.
And that just sums it up, doesn't it? The part of the book that really stuck with me was the meeting that all the black men held, where they all came together. And at first I was kind of terrified that the police were going to burst in and kind of accuse them of causing chaos or disturbances, or like planning things. So I was a little bit terrified, but it was so nice to see them all come together and create that community and just really be there for each other. And they said they wanted a space where they could talk openly, and like that is a safe space for them to come together. And it was so nice. And that just kind of underpins the whole book about how we all have more in common than our differences. If we talk to people, we can understand. We've all had feelings of like embarrassment or feeling frightened or alone and isolated. And going back to what we were saying about like divisiveness in the media and everything, we need to overcome that. Just like, we're all the same. We're not all the same, but we all go through certain experiences.
I think I also quite like that scene. I don't know why, but the kind of coming together of black people in a very white community in that sense, it was to support each other and stuff. But
yeah,
it kind of reminded me of what kind of Notting Hill Carnival and the coming together of black culture to celebrate black culture in a way that is pulling from their heritage from obviously their home countries and bringing it here.
Yeah.
Obviously that was less of a party, less of a celebration, but it was still that we need to build that sense of black community in this space where we currently don't necessarily feel like we're accepted.
And changing the narrative, not always hearing the negative.
So, yeah, allowing that space where you can be yourself unapologetically and not feel like you're being watched or being judged. There was loads of references there to being watched for being different, and I think that was quite powerful because there are certain places I go now and I feel like I'm being watched for being black on a kind of larger scale. Like, yes, there was a fair sized cohort of them, but they were still such a minority that they were effectively the only black person in the room. And that's why they had to come to be together. So I'd say they had that sense of community and not being isolated, not being alone. That's kind of, what I felt
that. Yeah, that kind of unity. Just on what you were saying, I remembered that I had noted a small quote from the book. He said, "He could go a day or so feeling perfectly normal, and then just a word or a glance was enough to remind him that he didn't belong." And actually, I was like, I get that. I get that. I mean, maybe every person that is different in some way understands that. There's always, you know, a particular instant that brings you, brings it all back to you.
Yeah.
I think that's why I find intersectionality so important, because even if you're a black person but also disabled, or black and also LGBTQ+, you can be in one community that makes one kind of aspect of you and what makes you you feel safe, but still feel alienated because another part of you doesn't fit the norm in that space. So yeah, intersectionality is so important. Well, kind of through the book, and kind of Evie being a woman of colour, and at first she was looking for black women coming to London, not just black people, because she wanted someone that was like her, that she could identify with on a personal level. And obviously she found Laurie, which is an amazing thing, but then she references it later in the book when she says, but she sees more black women, she's like, I can tell they're kind of newer here.
And I think for me, that's why I feel like we will never achieve complete equality if we're only looking at it from one lens. So it's not just about the improvement of how black people are treated or Asian people, it's all those other differences that you mentioned, you know, disabled or less able, LGBTQ+, sexuality, gender, whatever it is. It's almost, it's one fight that we should be doing together, because it benefits us all.
Yeah, Zenith, I couldn't agree more. I think that's the perfect note to end today's podcast on. Thank you so much to Zenith, Michael and Neera for joining me today and for offering such insightful conversation around this lovely city. I cannot wait to have you back with us soon. If you would like more from Essex Libraries or Black History Month, then find us on social media at Essex Libraries or online at www.libraries.essex.gov.uk, where we have reading lists and other great resources to help keep these important conversations going. If you have enjoyed today's podcast, then you can find more episodes on most streaming platforms, with our last episode being an exploration into all things alien with sound artist Chris Adam. Thanks once again to everyone who has helped make this episode possible, and I'll see you next time. Goodbye!